So the court in New York that is currently trying Donald Trump on charges that are completely specious, charges that, effectively speaking, he paid off Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election for electoral purposes as opposed to personal purposes, charges that have not been sustained by any sort of actual federal lawsuit against Donald Trump, any sort of federal criminal prosecution against Trump, that have been dragged into court by Alvin Bragg, an attention-seeking DA. What is all that about? Really, what it's about is humiliating Donald Trump, having people say salacious things about Donald Trump. I don't know why Democrats seem to think that this is going to affect Donald Trump in any way, shape, or form. Donald Trump has been part of the seamier side of American politics and business for literally decades. I mean, there's a reason that he was in a tape for Playboy. There is a reason that he was seen as a sort of Studio 54 guy for years and years and years. It's not as though Donald Trump has led the most pristine sexual life. And no one at this point is surprised by any of the allegations that were made in court yesterday. But that did not stop Democrats from dragging into court Stormy Daniels, heroine of the Republic. Because as it turns out, all it takes to be a heroine in American life now is to be a porn star who has sex with a married man and then effectively blackmails that married man for money. And then when the deal falls through, decides to go public with all of that to harm him. That is what heroism truly is. So long as that married man is a Republican. If that married man is a Democrat, then as we all know, it's time to wreck that person. If that married man is a Democrat, say Bill Clinton, then it's time to completely wreck Monica Lewinsky's life. That is how this all works. So all this came to a head yesterday. Donald Trump, prior to going into court yesterday, he suggested that all of this was coming out of the crooked Biden White House. The orders may not have come directly from the White House, but it is very clear that Democrats in the city of New York have decided that they are going to engage in electoral interference. That's what this stupid case is.
Every single legal scholar that I see, I mean, maybe there's somebody out there, some whack job, but for virtually everyone that I've seen has said there's absolutely no case. It's a case that shouldn't have been brought. The previous DA wouldn't bring it. Bragg didn't want to bring it, and he brought it because I'm running in number one place. This all comes out of the White House and crooked Joe Biden. This comes from the White House, and it's all Biden because it's an attack on his political opponent. That hasn't happened in this country. It does happen in third world countries, but it hasn't happened in this country. And it's a shame. And the trial is a very unfair trial. It's a very, very unfair trial. The good news is they have nothing. Thank you.
Okay, so he then went into the courtroom where Judge Juan Merchan, who is absolutely oriented against Donald Trump at this particular trial, he decided to allow the testimony of Stormy Daniels. Now, let us be extremely clear. There is no legal reason that Stormy Daniels had to testify. She literally brought nothing useful to the court. There was no reason whatsoever that she had to be in the courtroom. And whether or not she had sex with Donald Trump actually is completely irrelevant to the charges that are being brought. Because, again, the charges that are being brought are about whether he, via his lawyer, Michael Cohen, paid her off prior to the election via Michael Cohen and then reimbursed Michael Cohen after the election, and whether it was a campaign finance expense as opposed to a personal payoff designed to quash the rumors so as not to bother his wife, Melania. Right? The case the defense is making is that this is the kind of payment that is constantly made in American life. You can't just pin it on the election. And the case the prosecution is trying to make is that this was all about stealing the 2016 election by silencing Stormy Daniels, as though, by the way, any of the Stormy Daniels material coming out prior to the 2016 election would have saved Hillary Clinton. You know how we know that isn't the truth? Because there was a literal tape of the President of the United States talking about grabbing women by their genitals, and then he still won. So do you think that a tryst with a porn star would have changed the outcome in 2016? But again, there's no legal reason to allow this in the courtroom. So what did the judge do? He allowed it in the courtroom. And then not only did he allow it in the courtroom, he then proceeded to get angry that he allowed it in the courtroom, as it turns out. We'll get to that in just one moment. So Daniels talked about her sexual tryst with Donald Trump in 2006. Now, you may be asking yourself, wait, isn't the year 2024? Isn't this almost two decades ago? What the hell are we talking about Donald Trump's 2006 sex life for? Yes, that's because you're a rational human being. But we're talking about Donald Trump's 2006 sex life because they need some hat to hang their, some hook to hang their hat on to claim that he's a convicted felon. And so they're going to try and charge him. They literally charged him with 34 counts of felony campaign finance violation, a felony fraud in the city of New York. That is what they're attempting to do. And all it really was somehow just a lever to get Stormy Daniels in the room saying shameful things about Donald Trump. So according to the New York Times, her fast-paced testimony lasted nearly 5 hours, during which she described an encounter with Mr. Trump, now 77, that he has long denied. Tension gripped the courtroom, her garrulous testimony filling a heavy silence. She made jokes. They did not land. After about a half hour on the stand, she began to unspool intimate details about Mr. Trump, so much so that the judge balked at some of the testimony. He implied it was gratuitously vulgar, and the defense sought a mistrial. By the way, he then rejected that, which is absurd. If he didn't like what she was testifying to, he shouldn't have allowed her to testify since she had literally nothing of legal merit to say. This whole thing was a put-up job, in other words. It was all designed so that Daniels could unspool this bizarre story about that one time that she slept with the future president. She said the future president had invited her to dinner inside his palatial Lake Tahoe hotel suite. He answered the door wearing silk pajamas. She made a Hugh Hefner joke at this point, as one would. When he was rude, she playfully spanked him with a rolled up magazine, a copy of Forbes, by the way. So all of this is just parodic. When she asked about his wife, he told her not to worry, that they didn't even sleep in the same room. At this point, by the way, Trump shook his head in disgust and muttered boldly to his lawyers. She then got into graphic details about the sexual encounter. She said it happened after she returned from the bathroom and found Trump in his boxer shorts and t-shirt. Then she's changing her story now, because her original story was that they had this awkward encounter that she didn't really enjoy, but she didn't say no. Now she treats it as though it's a quasi-rape. She tried to leave and he blocked her path, she said, though not, she said, in a threatening manner. The sex was brief, she said, and although she never said no, there was a power imbalance. I was staring up at the ceiling, wondering how I got there, she told the jury. Were you wondering how you got there, though? I mean, you literally went up to his room, and then you didn't say no as he had sex with you in any way, shape, or form that would have been discernible to the human eye. Plus, you literally have sex with people on camera for a living. I feel like this is not your first rodeo, so to speak. But according to the New York Times, the testimony was an astonishing moment in American political history. Really? In American political history? Seriously? And a crowning spectacle in trial full of them, a porn star across from a former and potentially future president telling the world what she was once paid to keep quiet about. I mean, first of all, let me just say at this point, she was not a porn star. At best, she was a porn supporting actress. I don't know what it takes to be a star, but I feel like if your IMDb is replete with things like Prairie Lust, then probably you're not a full scale, or Love in an Elevator, or Erotic Sins of My Neighbor, or Bikini Kitchen. I feel like you don't get to call yourself a porn star. These just don't seem like I don't know, classics of the genre. In any case, according to the New York Times, Ms. Daniels' story is not just a sordid kiss and tell. It spotlights what prosecutors say was Mr. Trump's criminality. He's accused of engineering the false business record scheme to cover up all traces of their tryst, the hush money, the repayment to Mr. Cohen, and yes, the sex. Okay, so all of this is ridiculous. Then, apparently, this is really funny. She said that money was not her motivation, that she just wanted to get her story out, which is weird, because it seems like when you take a $130,000 check, money might have been your motivation. She said, my motivation wasn't money. It was motivated out of fear, not money. Sure. By the way, she was reading the room, man. She decided to describe their sex down to the sexual position, at which point the judge was like, can you stop now? I don't want to hear this anymore. Miss Daniels was indignant. During some cross-examination, she parried effectively, performing even better than she did with her answers to prosecutors, according to the New York Times. Now, again, the attempt to turn Stormy Daniels into a resistance hero, which last time around culminated in the prosecution and jailing of her lawyer, Michael Avenatti, who for a time was also treated as a resistance hero, it is quite pathetic, obviously. But it's not designed to be anything other than a laugh line for the left wing. That's all this is, which is why journalists spent the day guffawing at Donald Trump. Now, I mean, I'm just going to put it out there. Warning to people on the left laughing at Donald Trump. Last time you laughed at Donald Trump, he then ran for president and won. Barack Obama made a joke about him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and he literally got mad, ran for president, and became president. So good luck with the laughter.
Where and how you first encountered Mr. Trump inside that hotel suite. Daniels, I said hello, met Trump right there, and I said hello, and he wanted to go into the living area. He was wearing silk or satin pajamas.
I'm sorry. I apologize. This is serious.
No.
I'm sorry.
Look,
I just had to laugh.
By the way, it's just getting started.
I know.
Yes. Meanwhile, on CNN, there were stifled guffaws as all of the journalists read about what was going on.
I was looking at Trump some, and he had a general kind of impassiveness, not glowering exactly, but obviously not happy. But the basic dynamic was jury to Stormy. And then again, I haven't seen Mayor Chun in this trial be so sort of irritated. And it came across, I think, as being irritated with her level of detail. That's something if you're the DA, you're worried about, because you don't want them to think that he, the judge, is actually displeased in any way with the witness.
Okay, but the judge was displeased with the witness, which of course raises the question as to why he allowed the witness in the first place, because he should not have. Is this going to hurt Trump in any serious way? Nah. It's not going to hurt Trump whatsoever. In fact, it will probably help Trump because it's also ridiculous and so stupid. And dragging Trump into court to talk about how he had sex with some chick in 2006 who had sex with people on camera for a living and then got paid a bunch of money not to talk about it and then talked about it. Like, I'm sorry. Is this supposed to damage Donald Trump in any real way? The answer, of course, is no. If this is the best Democrats have, they ain't got nothing. What's more, it turns out that now the case in Florida may not see the light of day. It turns out that that particular case is going to be delayed in a fairly serious way. Judge Eileen Cannon, in that particular case, has indefinitely postponed Trump's classified documents trial, which is the case that has the most well-predicated charges against Donald Trump. She cites significant issues around classified evidence that would need to be worked out before the federal criminal case goes to a jury, according to CNN. So she has now canceled the May trial date. She did not set a new date. So that pushes it probably after the election of 2024. So all the attempts to convict Donald Trump of something, if they're going to convict Donald Trump of something, it's going to have to be a January 6th charge. And those January 6th charges are very hard to make stick. They are very, very weak. So Donald Trump may get the last laugh in all of this, which is bad news for Joe Biden, because Joe Biden is in serious trouble. Brookings Institute, which is a left-leaning think tank, they put out a piece just a couple of days ago saying, quote, in 2020, Joe Biden beat incumbent Donald Trump by 4.5 percentage points in the national popular vote, but by a much narrower margin in the Electoral College. Will history repeat itself? As of this week, President Biden trails former President Trump by about 1.5 percentage points in the average of national polls, which puts him roughly 6 points behind where he was on Election Day 2020. A comparison between surveys indicates the distribution of the white vote has remained fairly stable in the aggregate and between those with and without college degrees. But there are major shifts away from Joe Biden among Black, Hispanic, and Asian voters. Surprisingly, Trump appears to have gained ground among college-educated Black and Hispanic voters, more than with less educated members of those groups, which is a really wild stat. So all the talk has been how Donald Trump is appealing to blue-collar Black and Hispanic. It turns out he's actually in larger ways appealing to college-educated Black and Hispanic voters who maybe aren't being taken in by all the woke insanity. Equally surprising, up to now, Trump has increased his support more among women than men. All of this is really bad news for Joe Biden. Where is it coming from? Well, it's coming from the fact that people are really concerned about inflation. 57% of Americans in a new Economist YouGov poll say that the number one economic factor they worry about most is the prices of goods and services they buy. When it comes to the swing states, Joe Biden's margin of change is dramatically worse. He is down 2.4 points from where he was in 2020 in Wisconsin, 4 points in Michigan from where he was, 3.5 in Pennsylvania, 5.5 in Arizona, 7 in Nevada, 4 in Georgia, 4.1 in North Carolina. So again, the president is losing serious ground in all of these areas. The way he thinks he is going to make this up, of course, is through simple mail-in voting and also presumably through catering to the far left base. That is a bad strategy. Now, when it comes to the mail-in voting, one of the great benefits that Joe Biden had in 2020 is, of course, the changes in the rules for mail-in voting. because of COVID. The fact that, again, the voting base in 2020 increased by some 20 million voters over the 2016 election. The total presidential vote in 2016 was 137.5 million. In 2020 is 154.6 million. That is the largest increase between consecutive presidential elections in modern American history. Is that going to repeat itself this time? Probably not, which is why Joe Biden is now apparently engaging in some pretty shady dealings with regard to voter registration. According to Fox News, the House Committee on Small Business is now subpoenaing the Small Business Administration on Tuesday over what it says is a lack of transparency on alleged efforts by the Biden administration to funnel resources to Michigan to register voters. On Tuesday, the committee subpoenaed the Small Business Administration chief of staff, a guy named Arthur Plews, and his special advisor. There are said to have been no-shows at scheduled transcribed interviews with the committee. Apparently, there is a program being funded by the federal government, your taxpayer dollars, quote, diverting its resources away from assisting Main Street so it can register Democrat voters in Michigan. In March, Biden's Small Business Administration announced a memorandum of understanding with the Michigan Department of State to, quote, promote civic engagement and voter registration in Michigan. In a press release, the SBA administrator, Isabel Casillas Guzman, said the partnership, quote, will help connect Michiganders to vital voter registration information from the state of Michigan so more small business owners can exercise the right to vote. Okay, that is obviously a ridiculous con. Funneling money to Small Business Administration sources so they can register Democratic voters obviously is a violation of the law. But that's what Joe Biden is relegated to at this point because he is running so weak. And again, the biggest weakness for Joe Biden is just the fact he ran as a moderate. He has governed as a far leftist. And he, for some odd reason, can't bring it back to reality. He cannot bring it back to the center. Maybe it's because Barack Obama was such a far left president that he feels the necessity to follow in those footsteps. Maybe it's because all the people who surround him are radical left nut jobs who are holdovers from the Obama administration. Whatever it is, Joe Biden is totally incapable of dragging his party or his campaign back toward moderation in the middle. So yesterday, Joe Biden gave a speech on anti-Semitism in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day, Yom Shoah, in Israel. And he talked about anti-Semitism breaking out all over the world and the problems with anti-Semitism. He started off by talking about how there has been a giant upsurge of anti-Semitism all across the world. Here he was.
We've seen a ferocious surge of anti-Semitism in America and around the world. Vicious propaganda on social media. Jews forced to keep their hide, their keepers under baseball hats, tuck their Jewish stars into their shirts. On college campuses, Jewish students blocked, harassed, attacked while walking to class. Anti-Semitism, anti-Semitic posters, slogans calling for the annihilation of Israel, the world's only Jewish state. Too many people denying, downplaying, rationalizing, ignoring the horrors of the Holocaust. And October 7th, including Hamas's appalling use of sexual violence to torture and terrorize Jews. It's absolutely despicable, and it must stop.
Okay, well, he's saying that it must stop. He is right that around the world, there's a massive upsurge in anti-Semitism. So why is Joe Biden having such a tough time actually siding against the protesters, for example, on the merits? Why is he having such a tough time allowing Israel to finish off Hamas in the Gaza Strip? What exactly is the difficulty here? So Joe Biden, in the middle of the speech, he started talking about the horrors of October 7th and how easy it was for people to forget them. Here's what he had to say.
Here we are. Not 75 years later, but just 7.5 months later. And people are already forgetting. They're already forgetting that Hamas unleashed this terror. It was Hamas that brutalized Israelis. It was Hamas who took and continues to hold hostages. I have not forgotten, nor have you. And we will not forget.
Okay, well, for a person who hasn't forgotten, it's pretty weird that he is attempting to now pressure Israel into leaving Hamas in power in Rafah. This is the part that's super weird. How can Joe Biden possibly justify what his administration is doing in Rafah, or Rafia, as it's called in Hebrew. How can they possibly justify this? If Hamas is left intact in Rafah, that means that Hamas will walk out, declare victory, and then be a governing party in the future in the very region where they created a massive terror hideaway. What exactly, how does that benefit the United States? How does that benefit Israel? How does that benefit the Palestinians? How does that benefit anybody? But that's the game that Joe Biden is currently playing. So Joe Biden is denouncing anti-Semitism. He won't do it within his own party, obviously. And he certainly won't do it with regard to actual policy. He is currently, apparently, denying Israel access to targeting weaponry. You know, the kind of weaponry that would actually minimize civilian casualties. That's precisely the kind of ammo he's denying Israel. Meanwhile, Israel has taken operational control of the Gazan side of the Rafah crossing with Egypt, which is designed to prevent the escape of members of Hamas. The United States, however, is protesting. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said on Tuesday that Israel had told the Biden administration it would reopen the Kerem Shalom crossing on Wednesday and the Rafah crossing shortly after. She said, "We are insisting there should be no disruptions of humanitarian assistance flows. The only reason there was any disruption in the first place is because all of these areas were shot at by Hamas." By Hamas. Meanwhile, Hamas is saying that the ball is in Israel's court. At a news conference in the Lebanese capital on Tuesday, Hamas official Osama Hamdan said the group had made enough concessions in Qatari-Egyptian broker talks and warned there would be no ceasefire if Israel continued its incursion into Rafah. Hamdan said, quote, "The Hamas movement and the Palestinian resistance will not respond to any initiative to stop the aggression or an exchange deal under military pressure and escalation of aggression." Hamdan said that Hamas had shown flexibility. The demands included an end to all hostilities, the return of everyone to the northern Gaza Strip, including terrorists, the withdrawal of all Israeli troops from Gaza, billions of dollars in reconstruction and relief, and hundreds, if not thousands, of Palestinian murderers and terrorists let out of Israeli jails. And then he said the ball's in Israel's court. Now, what exactly is the rationale for that? The answer is that the United States is pressuring Israel into accepting Hamas's continued existence. This is insane. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said yesterday, quote, "A hostage release deal should be able to close the remaining gaps." He said everybody is coming to the table. That's not insignificant. "We believe that where we see the text right now, we see no reason why they can't overcome those remaining gaps." Asked how Hamas's insistence that Israel end the war could be reconciled with Israel's determination to end Hamas, Kirby said, "I don't want to get into talking about the specific parameters. I think it's best to let the negotiators hammer out those existing gaps." Okay, can we just explain where these existing gaps are? Right now, Israel says, "We would like all of our hostages released." Hamas says no. So Israel says, "How about 33 of the hostages?" Hamas says, "How about 33 bodies?" Not joking. Dead people. How about that? Israel says, "How about a temporary ceasefire to allow everybody to breathe, get some humanitarian aid in, but we're not going to end the war against you." And the answer from Hamas is, "What if we just say that the war is over?" And it is over. How about that? These are not small gaps. The United States is now playing PR agency for an actual honest-to-God terror group. That is what he is doing right now. That is the effect of what he is doing. And he's providing cover to actual anti-Semites over at the United Nations, which again, the United Nations is replete with nations that are radically anti-Semitic and anti-Israel. Joe Biden is providing cover for those people at the same time that he's saying that he's fighting anti-Semitism. And this is the amazing part about this administration. They say they condemn anti-Semitism at the same time that they are providing and flying cover for Hamas. Meanwhile, on campus, they say things like, "Yes, we're fighting anti-Semitism on campus. We think anti-Semitism is bad." But the only harsh words that they've said about the viewpoint of any protester, they found a protester, one guy, apparently, at like the University of Missouri, like one dude who they say, or is it Ole Miss? They found one dude at Ole Miss who they're accusing of being a racist based on a second and a half of footage in which a person seems to make ape-like noises at a black woman. But it's not clear whether that's actually what's going on there. Could be a Covington Catholic kind of thing. Doesn't stop the White House. The White House says, that's egregious. That's where we got to draw the line. And yet when it comes to tens of thousands of protesters chanting for the extermination of Israel every single day. The Biden administration is like, well, they do, you know, they do have passionate perspectives, many passionate perspectives. So the head of the education department, Cardona, Miguel Cardona, yesterday he testified in front of Congress. And he said two consecutive things. One, he said Title VI forbids anti-Semitism on campus. Okay, so as we've discussed, Title VI provides serious free speech issues. It's a real problem, Title VI. But Title VI says that colleges that receive federal funding cannot allow discriminatory environments on the basis of ethnicity, race, sexual orientation, and the like. That's what Title VI is designed to do. And that includes anti-Semitism. Here's Cardone admitting as much.
The Biden-Harris administration, including the Department of Education, is taking action each and every day to help ensure that schools and colleges are free from discrimination and safe for Jewish students and all students, and will continue to do so. Make no mistake, anti-Semitism is discrimination and is prohibited by Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Dissent is essential to democracy. But dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the right of others so students can finish their semester and their college education.
Okay. And then he immediately backed that up with, he was asked about campus encampments that are promoting anti-Semitism. And he's like, I don't know about, maybe they're okay. Maybe.
I condemn behaviors that are unsafe, and I leave it to the university leaders and their board of governors to address how they handle encampments or other issues that are happening on campus. What I will say is acts of intimidation or violence toward Jewish students or any students for that matter are not tolerated. That's not, as the president said, that's not protesting. That's creating
I appreciate that, and that's an important message. But the encampments themselves, when they violate university policies and the law, do you condemn them?
The university has a responsibility to follow to uphold their rules on campus and
act. So can you tell me right now, yes or no, if you condemn these encampments?
Again, those are decisions for the universities to make. I know that in some cases, universities are engaging in dialogue with students to come up with a strategy out.
So that's a no. He won't condemn those encampments. And he will back administrators who continue to cave to them. Why? Because Joe Biden is happy to mouth platitudes about anti-Semitism. But when it comes to fighting the actual Nazis of today, the members of Hamas and their allies, then all of a sudden, they're kind of sketch on it. You know, they got some concerns. That's when they start to get a little squirrely. Meanwhile, the administrators at all these college campuses continue to cave. UCLA has now canceled all in-person classes on Monday after protests continued on the campus for a second week. All classes will now be held remotely through the end of the week. Just pathetic. Just absolutely pathetic. That is a state-run university. It is a violation of the law. And these morons continue to cater to them. Why? Because again, Joe Biden believes that he has to cater to the most radical people in order to win re-election. That is precisely, by the way, how he's going to lose re-election. It is truly amazing to me that people believe that the reason that Donald Trump won in 2016 is simply because there are a bunch of benighted fools in the hinterlands who are economically dispossessed. That is wrong. The reason that Donald Trump won in 2016 is because there is an elite group of people at the top of nearly all of America's major institutions who hate traditional American values, truly despise them, think they're bad. We're watching it in practice right now. You want Trump to win? Keep backing those people. Keep hollowing out America's institutions and wearing their faces around like Hannibal Lecter from Silence of the Lambs. We'll get to more of that in just one second. First, a very special message from our friend Adam Carolla.
Catch the series premiere of Mr. Burcham this Sunday, 9 o'clock, 8 Central, exclusively on Daily Wire Plus. Episode 1 is streaming for free, so no excuses, people. Mr. Burcham is decades in the making, and now it's showtime. Check out the Mr. Burcham trailer and see what the fuss is all about.
I found some really great school uniform options to avoid misgendering.
What about their allergies? Maybe those days could be lactose intolerant.
No, we can't say intolerance. We have a zero tolerance policy for mentioning intolerance.
When I was a kid, men were men. Now everyone's wrapped up in feelings.
Real men stuff feelings down with red meat, cigarettes, and violence.
My name is Mr. Wolf. I solve problems.
You know what it takes? Balls. Eyeballs.
Who's going to say that we're too young?
Well, actually, I was going to say you're too fat.
And the geriatric Girl Scouts will be passed out in an hour!
Pass Mommy the wine. The bottle.
Don't make this a prison hug.
Richard Bertram.
Bertram?
Bertram.
Mr. Bertram.
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 Let the record show I'm a dick.
Mr. Bertram, an all-new animated series from Daily Wire Plus. Premieres May 12th.
Remember, Mr. Bertram's series premiere this Sunday, 9 o'clock, 8 central. Stream it free only on Daily Wire Plus.
Now, speaking of institutions that have been completely hollowed out and destroyed, the Boy Scouts have now decided they're going to rename themselves to be more inclusive. And this is just the final step in the hollowing out of the Boy Scouts as an organization, which is truly, really sad because the Boy Scouts used to be, again, one of those social institutions outside of government, one of those social fabric building institutions that allowed people to know their neighbors, make friends, develop actual values. The values of the Boy Scouts were good religious values. The founder of the Boy Scouts was a religious Christian. And one of the actual things that Boy Scouts had to abide by was duty to God. That was actually in the original kind of oath that you would take as a Boy Scout. Well, over time, they've gotten rid of a lot of that. They've secularized it. They've gotten rid of all of the original values. And now they're getting rid of the name Boy Scouts because, after all, they wouldn't want to feel non-inclusive for girls who think they're boys and stuff like that. By the way, if you're the kind of person who thinks Boy Scouts is non-inclusive, may I recommend that you get your head examined? Like, what's wrong with you? Why can't there just be a group where boys can get together and learn how to, like, build a campfire or something? Hell's wrong with you people. You want to know why so much of red state America is getting redder? It's because of crap like this. As a famous person once said, Boy Scouts is for boys. It's in the name Boy Scouts. In any case, here's Roger Krone, the CEO of the Boy Scouts of America. They're renaming themselves.
Sends this really strong message to everyone in America that they can come to this program, they can bring their authentic self, they can be who they are, right? And they will be welcomed here. The argument that I make with the people that say, well, I always like Boy Scouts of America or BSA, why do we have to change? Go, you know, membership is at historic lows, right? Part of my job is to reduce all the barriers I possibly can for people to accept us as an organization and to join.
Okay, this is exactly what's wrong with institutional America. That last line right there is the problem. This is true for churches, it's true for the Boy Scouts, it's true for synagogues, it's true for everyone. Every traditionalist institution, when they say, our job is to lower the barriers of entry so you can enter, so everyone can bring their authentic selves, you want to know why no one wants to join your organization? It's because of that. The reason people join institutions and organizations is to be shaped by those organizations and institutions. The reason you become a Boy Scout is to cultivate the skill set necessary to become an Eagle Scout, to become better at things. That is literally the reason. Not because the Boy Scouts are seeking your authentic self, but because you are supposed to conform to certain roles. You are supposed to learn things from people who know things, because the set of values that is promulgated by the institution is supposed to be taken in and integrated into your life. This is also true for churches. You hear this from churches all the damn time. Failing churches, I should say. You hear it from pastors and priests, people who will say things like, well, you know, the reason I put this gay pride flag on the outside of my church is because I want to say that you should come as your authentic self because we welcome everyone. We want to get rid of the barriers to entry. So I have a question. If a gay couple has the choice between going to a really nice restaurant with some nice guitar music with a gay pride flag out front or to your church on a Sunday morning, which one do you think they're going to do? Which one? The reason people engage with institutions is because the institutions have value to them. And that means that their values cannot shift and change in order to get more butts in the pews or more seats around the campfire. The reason the Boy Scouts has been withering away over the course of the last several decades has nothing to do with the Boy Scouts' conservatism. It has everything to do with the fact that the Boy Scouts have been destroyed by progressivism. It has to do with the fact that courts decided that Boy Scouts couldn't even have standards for their own scoutmasters. It's because the Boy Scouts decided there could be girls in the Boy Scouts. If you want a successful institution, you stick to your guns and you hold to those guns no matter what. But again, the middle management of American life has decided that it's very important to cater to the new tolerant and diverse worldview of the United States, which, by the way, does not give a... You think a bunch of lib kids are going to start coming to Scouts of America or whatever the hell they're calling themselves now? You think all of a sudden this place is going to be filled by San Francisco trans kids? That's not the next step here. The next step is that the organization just doesn't exist. Just another pathetic attempt to empty out traditional historic American institutions. That's what that is. And then you wonder why there's a backlash in the form of things like Trump. Because when people feel so panicked about institutions being destroyed, they go to the great destroyer himself, who threatens to just break every piece of China in the China shop. That's how you end up with all of this stuff. By the way, the great purveyors of diversity, equity, and inclusion, very often it is they who are the most racist, of course, because wokeness itself is racist. Wokeness itself is the argument that race ought to be predominant over the individual. And so many of its purveyors happen to think in incredibly racist ways. That famous meme from comedian Ryan Long of the woke and the racist guy sharing spaces and ideas, right? That's true. So here is Kathy Hochul, a devotee of the woke cult, explaining that the big problem for black people in America is they don't know the word computer. Don't worry, she's not a racist. She's just saying something super kind of racist.
Young black kids growing up in the Bronx who don't even know what the word computer is. They don't know. They don't know these things. And I want the world open up to all of them, because when you have their diverse voices innovating solutions through technology, then you're really addressing society's broader challenges.
I'm pretty sure that black kids know what a computer is, because we're not living in 1972. I'm pretty sure. But again, I guess if you're woke, you get away with this kind of stuff. If you're a Republican, you say that black kids don't know what the word computer. I have a feeling like that would be a problem for Republicans. I don't know, call me crazy. I think that'd be a problem. Okay, meanwhile, Joe Biden continues to be unpopular also because he is absolutely weak on foreign policy. So a U.S. soldier has now been detained in Russia. That U.S. soldier is being accused of theft. This is what officials are saying. According to NBC News, the soldier is Staff Sergeant Gordon Black. He'd been stationed in South Korea and traveled to Russia on his own, not on official business, according to four U.S. officials. By the way, bad move. Always bad move. Whether you are a U.S. soldier or whether you are Brittany Griner, going to Russia, not generally a wise move. He had finished his deployment. He was heading back to the United States when he made a side trip to Vladivostok, Russia, to visit a woman with whom he was romantically involved, according to officials. Apparently, he traveled there without permission from his superiors. The soldier is accused of stealing from a woman, the official said, and they just arrested him. He has been apprehended on charges of criminal misconduct. The Army notified his family, and the U.S. Department of State is providing consular support to this soldier. So, totally unclear what exactly the crime was. This could just be Russia seizing yet another American citizen to hold hostage, because as it turns out, this administration is very fond of groups that hold people hostage. They're perfectly willing to provide cover for those people, whether it's Hamas holding Americans hostage or Russia holding Americans hostage. Here's Karine Jean-Pierre suggesting that American citizens who are currently in Russia should leave. Yeah, you think?
We take seriously our commitment to assist U.S. citizens abroad and provide all appropriate assistance. We iterate, and this is kind of to your question, we iterate our strong warnings about danger posed to U.S. citizens in Russia. We have been very clear about this. State Department has been very clear about this, and we will continue to say U.S. citizens residing or traveling in Russia should depart immediately. As stated in our travel advisory for Russia, and U.S. citizens should not travel to Russia at this time, period. And we're going to continue to be very, very clear about that.
So, yeah, because you have not stood up to Russia in really any significant way. You slow-walked all the aid to Ukraine. You've allowed Russia to continue to flex its muscles in the Middle East. Vladimir Putin, by the way, just enshrined himself for another 6 years in the leadership of Russia. Attending that ceremony was Steven Seagal. I kid you not. That is our world now. Steven Seagal ushering in the new era of Putinism. Well, at least our media are focused on the real issues. Joy Reid, who in her own skull is the repository of at least 27% of all human stupidity. She had some words about Vladimir Putin and his habit of taking hostages. She was particularly upset that Vladimir Putin had grabbed Brittany Griner for bringing marijuana seed oil or something into Russia. She says that Putin grabbed a black queer woman in order to cause trauma, particular trauma in America. I didn't realize that like, I feel like seizing the journalist from the Wall Street Journal is a little more traumatic than seizing the WNBA player, but apparently Joy Reid feels differently.
It's, to me, sort of shocking to think about spending nearly a year far from home, wondering if you'll ever get out. Because she was sentenced to 9 years, 9.5 years incarceration for what in this country would amount to nothing, and for something that wasn't even deliberate. But I think the Putin regime understood that they had not just a black celebrity, a black queer celebrity, somebody who could be used internally as a pawn, somebody who they could sort of internally mock and hold hostage from the United States, knowing the trauma that it would cause back home.
Yes. Joy Reid, she is so wise. Okay, meanwhile, the Republicans, you know, all they really have to do is stay out of their own way, which means that Donald Trump certainly should stay away from Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota. So I don't, first rule of holes, man, stop digging. So Kristi Noem was on Fox News yesterday, and she got mad at Stuart Varney, notorious lib Stuart Varney, for asking her about her weird story about how she shot a dog at a gravel pit or something, and she got mad.
Do you still think that you are in line to be Trump's vice president?
No, it's up to Donald Trump. He's the only person who will decide this. He's the only person who will decide. And I spoke. Yes, I do speak to him.
May I ask what he said to you about being vice president?
I never tell anybody my personal conversations.
Did the dog story come up in a conversation with Trump?
I talk to President Trump all the time.
About the dog?
About a lot of things. And right now, I tell you what, he is being persecuted in a political hunt. Witch hunt in this court case. So I'm proud of him about how tough he is and how well he is doing.
Did you bring up
yes,
the dog?
Yes, enough, Stuart.
With Trump. Did you
this
bring
interview
up the dog
is
with
ridiculous,
Trump?
What you were doing right now.
I don't
so you
so.
Need to stop. It is.
Okay.
It is.
We'll
Let's
stop.
Talk about some real topics that Americans care about.
I'm afraid we're out of time.
Oh, well, of course we are.
Well, first rule of shooting a dog, don't talk about it in your book. Second rule of shooting a dog, don't then go on a national media tour after you write about it in your book. Let's say, yeah, she's not going to be Donald Trump's vice presidential. But by the way, Trump is running a significantly more disciplined campaign than he did in 2020. Just as an example, Trump is trying to quell this idiotic attempt by Marjorie Taylor Greene and the clown squad in Congress to overthrow the current Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson. According to Politico, he's going further than just public statements supporting Speaker Mike Johnson. He's trying to mediate between Johnson and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. Trump and the Georgia firebrand speak often had a lengthy phone call over the weekend, according to three Republicans familiar with the matter. Trump's message to her, stand down from the so-called motion to vacate. Representative Ryan Zinke of Montana, he said, I have it under very good sources that President Trump engaged. I'm hoping that perhaps one would come to the conclusion you made your point. Don't be kamikaze. If you go for this, you're going to get beaten down. He made that point. I'm hoping that's the outcome. He told her not to do it. And Donald Trump is smart enough to recognize that a interior battle inside the Republican Party does not help his presidential campaign in any way, shape, or form. All right, coming up, we're going to jump into the vaunted Ben Shapiro Show mailbag. If you're not a member, become a member. Use code Shapiro. Check out for 2 months free on all annual plans. Click that link in the description and join us.